Okay, try that again. Good morning. I want to greet each one of you in Jesus' name. I should have probably, some of you got warned about this, others not so much. Once I knew that Ernie was going to that funeral, that kind of brought my turn to preach up a week sooner. And I'd spent a good chunk of my week working on this certain subject that I was supposed to have tonight. And I'm not a good multitasker. And so after considering the matter, I thought I got this bright idea that I could share kind of the foundational part of what I share tonight with the married couples and then just stick to more of the mechanics with them. So I'm not necessarily going to try to run you all through a marriage seminar, so lay down your fears. I'd like to talk about something this morning I think we all have. Gordon, you could just do the top. You don't have to do the middle yet because we'll have some reading. So I'm not going to run you all through that part, but I'd like to talk about laying a foundation that goes on in marriage. How many of you are familiar with what I call the spillover effect? We're pretty familiar, right? If you fill your cup too full, there it goes, spillover. And that's what we talk about. A lot of our life basically constitutes spillover of various degrees. Some of that's good, some of it harmless, and some of it not good at all. And in this subject, it's probably one of those that has a lot of spillover. So what I'm talking about is something every last one of us has, but I'm going to say very few, probably none, for sure not me, understand, even though I'm going to talk about it. We attempt to understand it, and we've got all kinds of devious ways. And you know, the comforting thing about it is the more research I did, I found these multiple people that said they have spent 30 years studying this, and they still don't agree with each other. So maybe agreement isn't so important as thought. And seeing what, and I also want to, of course, look at what God says about it in Scripture. So how many of you have feelings and emotions? Everybody has feelings and emotions. I kind of figured that. You know, as we think of the mental process, what happens in our brains, stop stepping on that book. Basically, everything you think about deals with one or two aspects. It's either feelings or facts. And that's fairly broad, and I'm not trying to suggest that you can necessarily go into your mind and totally disconnect everything. So let's just, for example, if I would tell you I'm hungry, and you have no basis to know how much I had for breakfast, you'd have no I thought about, well, let's say you couldn't even see my size or anything, I would just say I'm hungry. Would that be a fact or a feeling? Anyone? Okay, but the fact is I'll die if I don't eat, right? Isn't that a fact? I'm not disagreeing with you because my personal hunger generally comes as a feeling, correct? But hunger is a fact. So it's pretty difficult to say where one stops and the other one starts because finally, if you don't eat, you die. And so we can deduce that hunger is a fact. At the same time, my hunger pangs are a feeling that I experience. So that's just to tell you how complicated this gets, I guess, in a small scale. So I'm going to suggest all of us have feelings and emotions. And it looks like most of you would agree with me on that. But we relate to feelings and emotions very differently based on a couple things. One is culture. Different cultures relate to different things the same way. I'll get into that a little bit. The other thing is even genders do, right? And again, that's something I'll expound on a little bit more. And so we all have them, yet we might relate radically different to the same thing. Maybe just taking that thought on a bit further is, so we have, if you get into personality types, one word we use is introvert and extrovert. So an extrovert is, think of exterior. He looks out from himself. And he's happy. He likes to see what other people are doing. He wants to know what's happening. And he sees everybody and everything. So when you have a happy extrovert, what happens? He's what we might call exuberant, right? He's singing, happy, wants to know how you are, and he's excited about affecting everybody with his happiness. Well, an introvert, think of in, an introvert focuses inwards. So you have a happy introvert, he might hum a quiet tune, but he's not jumping around for joy necessarily. He just responds totally different to the same emotion of happiness. Sadness, you would have the same thing. You might have this one person. We got a lot of these in our house. They wail loudly at every big problem that comes in their life. You know, the whole world needs to know I have a bad day. Extrovert, sort of. Introvert is, they're just quiet. They're clammy. Best just let them alone. Okay, a little bit of introductory thoughts there. So these different ways of dealing with feelings and emotions, I think, I have to say this carefully, we're intended by God, shall I say, to be a thing of beauty and strength in human relationships. That's how I view them. But once with sin and the fall, they're also all these strengths and beauty that they potentially have also come with a weakness and a confusing ugliness, if we allow it to. And that's where the thing of choice enters into emotion. You know, we can so quickly misunderstand and misjudge each other very quickly and sometimes completely. Have you ever done that? You just knew somebody had this motive or did this thing for this reason. And then maybe sometime for some reason, either you were brave or a chance brought it in your way that you sat down and you found out there was a totally different reason than what you said they had. Wow, ouch. So there much goes my intuition, right? Okay. So like I mentioned already, something as simple as hunger actually becomes complex in its spillover effect. Let's go back to being hungry. Think of Esau, right? Isn't Esau the most famous hungry man in the Bible? Probably, I don't know. We remember him well for his needing that bowl of soup so bad. What was brought out in one of our discussions that I appreciated was that why don't we remember Jacob for being selling soup for such a high exorbitant price? Or anyway, it's all involved. But Esau got hungry, and he allowed that hunger to actually make him willing to sacrifice something that wasn't worth a bowl of soup at all. So in going into this a little bit deeper, am I on the right one? Usually I have a preview, and it's not working for me. Let me see. Maybe I should just... No. Try this again. There we go. See what happens next here. Okay. So in thinking of the human experience, like I've preached here, like one of our sessions was, we're made up of a three-part being, and I apologize, I actually have this design for a black background, not a white, and so some of this is going to be, and I didn't have time to redo it for this setting, so I'll let it. But we're physical, we all understand that. We're the mental and emotional aspect, which to a degree we understand, and the spiritual, which is the part for us made with God. And these all have spillover, they flow and affect each other. For example, we would say physical problems are generally resolved through diet, exercise therapy, rest, sleep, medical help, herbal helps, maybe a change of climate. But interestingly enough, it doesn't stop there. A doctor I use some of his material, he said that up to, I think it was, he divided it roughly into thirds, but roughly 70% of the people he treated for physical problems actually had spiritual and emotional needs he felt at the root of their physical problem. Right? So if you're having a big physical problem, I'm not suggesting you don't go to the doctor if you have the flu or need an appendicitis taken out, or appendix taken out, have appendicitis. But remember that in a lot of things, there's spillover, and a lot of people that have, especially some of the diseases he names, stress for one, it's unreal how often that stems back to unresolved spiritual and maybe relationship issues. And so in thinking about that, you deal with that, but that said, it also flows the other way. So in other words, now let's go to the mental-emotional. Resolving mental and emotional problems. First of all, I have to realize that feelings do not need to define who I am, because potentially I may not feel good just because I'm short on sleep. Maybe I don't have a good diet. Maybe I'm not getting enough exercise. Those can actually all flow into there, but just as they can flow the other way. Of course, if you're having emotional problems, experiencing nurture, care, and understanding helps, and that's some of what I'll be talking to the married people tonight. And then also have a safe place to share your thoughts can help. But then along with that, if you have emotional problems, generally it's going to help a lot if you resolve any linking spiritual and physical problems. You have to see that we're interconnected. We live in an interconnected world where you cannot necessarily separate one from the other. So then we have spiritual problems. Resolving spiritual problems, we seek God through his word and prayer, of course. We seek the guidance of a mature Christian. We live by faith in God. And we have to see God as the only hope and source of truth. So I'm going to be dwelling on the emotional aspect this morning, but in that, there's a real danger that as you listen to me, you're going to say that all my emotional problems can be fixed by dwelling on the emotional. That's not true, right? Potentially, if you have, you or someone you know that has emotional problems, it's not as simple as dwelling on the emotional aspect. Potentially, you need to deal with the spiritual issues and the physical issues, and I don't have time to pull those all in. So does that make sense? Fair enough. So I just want to be clear on that, because I don't want anybody, potentially, when you talk to any group this size, you have some people that struggle with depression. And I'm not trying to make depression a simple thing. It's complex. There's different facets. At the same time, you do need to work on it. Okay, enough of that. Another thing to remember is I'm focusing primarily on looking into my own heart and understanding my own feelings and emotions, and then at least starting to try to understand others through the same process. And that's where I feel a little bad. I don't know if this deserves to be called a message. I told someone that's more seminarish, but I didn't have anybody that stood in my way, so I guess we'll go ahead, and hopefully you can use at least a few of these things. So if you feed a hungry man, excuse me, I'm getting ahead of myself. If you see a person that's dying of starvation, what is your response? What's the first thing you as a Christian should do, anyone? Feed him, right? But how are you helping him not? Shouldn't you convert him first? So, yeah, no, I agree with you. If you see somebody that's dying of starvation, feed him by all means. Because, finally, feeding a hungry person becomes a means of sharing the gospel, right? If he's so hungry, if he's actually dying of starvation, let's say, he's not going to be able to listen to you share the gospel if you've got a plate of food in front of it. Or the potential to have. And so you share the gospel by caring, first of all, for that physical need. And in the emotional aspect, I would like to point that out as well. If you see somebody that's struggling emotionally, oftentimes I see them get pounded with the spiritual need that they may have in their life. And that's not, I'm not suggesting, often I find probably 90% of the time of the research I've done, there is spiritual needs where there's emotional problems. But you don't gain them for Christ by hitting them with the truth so much as you do by, first of all, caring for them as a person. Am I making sense there? I hope. And that's just like feeding a hungry person. That makes sense. And so remember that process, because this thing can be really stigmatized and blown out of proportion in some of this. Okay, so I think I went enough. How many ditches does a good road have? Anyone? Two, right? Because you have to have a crown in the middle, and so you got to have a place for both water on both sides to go. So you need two ditches, and the devil's pretty good at digging two ditches for God's road, if you ever thought about it. So thinking about this thing of emotions, I think as God created man and woman, and he looked at them, he said they were created good. It was beautiful, and that included their emotions. Now, that didn't include what we call bad emotions today. But God called it good. So as in all things originally created by God, Satan contorts, that means he twists, or distorts, that means he messes up, as much as he possibly can so as to spoil and ruin God's plan and original intent. And in the subject of feelings and emotions, this distortion and contortion often takes two very distinct routes. And that is the one you have some people that deny their feelings and emotions. They deny, they cover up, they try to hide. You ask them how they are. Good, even if they feel suicidal, for example. That's not true. They're not feeling good. Or you have the opposite extreme, where those who they make their feelings, the way they feel at the moment, and their emotions, they make it a god that everything else has to kowtow to, which basically means to bow down to. And maybe some extremes that just came to my mind real recent in thinking of this are the American Indians. Any of those you that enjoys American Indian history, they were what I would call stoic, right? To show surprise or extreme emotion to an especially a brave was humiliating. To be surprised into showing fear or anger even, no, you just didn't do it. They were proud about how much they could hide. Today, the culture we live in has kind of gone about as far the other way as you possibly could, because today there are a lot of psychologists and so on are teaching parents that you actually should let your child determine their gender by how they feel about it. Well, and a child doesn't even have a potentially know how a gender feels. I don't even. I've been a man for 30-some years, and I still don't know how a gender feels. I feel like a man, right? And that's how garbled this whole thing can get, to where you covering up, hiding, denying is not necessarily God's way. But having them control, dictate, and manipulate you is not God's way either. So let me ask you a question. How many of you would say, how shall I say this? Do you control your feelings and emotions, or do they control you? Well, why don't we go ahead and answer that? I need about 5 people to read verses for me. So I'll just give this out. 2 Timothy 1, verse 7. Anyone? Just repeat it, please. And I'll come back. I'd just like for y'all to stand and read them clearly for everyone then. Just, that was 2 Timothy 1, 7. The next one is Ecclesiastes 3, verse 4. Proverbs 29, verse 11. Joshua 1, 9. And Romans 12, 15. So do you control your feelings and emotions, or do they control you? Are your feelings and emotions hardwired that they just trigger in response to whatever you're facing? Or is there perchance a way that you can program them to trigger a certain way? Listen to these verses and let's let God speak to us first of all on that. So 2 Timothy chapter 1, verse 7. Please, yeah, just.
For God has not given us the spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of a sound mind.
If I could read that out of the ESV version. For God gave us a spirit, not of fear, but of power and of love and of self-control. So think about that. So God hasn't intended for us to be fearful, scared, controlled by our fear, but he has intended for us to have a sound mind, and to think clearly, and to be able to control ourselves. Ecclesiastes 3, verse 4 is kind of a grab out of the middle of a time, but that's all I need. So Ecclesiastes 3, verse 4.
A time to weep, a time to laugh, a time to mourn, and a time to dance.
Okay. So he's saying there is a time to weep, but he's also saying there's a time to laugh. There is a time to mourn, but there's also a time to feel good, to dance. Okay, Proverbs 29, verse 11. Okay, so a fool utters all his mind, but a wise man keeps it into afterwards. If I could read that in the ESV again, I just like some of the thoughts that gives. It says, a fool gives full vent to his spirit, but a wise man quietly holds it back. Okay, Joshua 1 verse 9 makes it actually a bit stronger yet. So he's saying, have I not commanded you, be strong, be of a good courage, and don't be dismayed, for I'm going to be with you wherever you go. Now it's actually taken from the level of saying that between a foolish and a wise man, it's actually commanding God's people to do this. Romans 12, verse 15. Okay, so kind of Ecclesiastes of the New Testament. It actually says to conform your emotions to correspond with those that you care for. Rejoice with those that do rejoice and weep with those that weep. So I'd like to now define the difference between feeling and emotion, if I may. And some of this, I want to be clear, some of this is biblical, some of it is my thoughts, and then I'll try to share where I use someone else's thoughts at least extensively. So feelings, I'd like to define feelings, my thoughts, that they're those unexpected impressions that wash over you, unlooked for and unexpected. So feelings, I would say, happen, right? They come. It's just not really a choice. It's what I would call an instinctive response to whatever happens. Somebody pulls out in front of you, that disgust at what they did is a feeling. Now, what you do with that is something else. And that's where emotion comes in. I'd like to think of emotions as consistent repetitions of certain feelings, the cultivation and expectation to feel a certain way. So you can't really help when a feeling comes, but you can help from repetitively experiencing the same feeling under the same situation as you give yourself to God, and went more into that a bit later. So feelings are those unexpected impressions that wash over you, unlooked for, very important there, and unexpected, because once you start looking for a certain feeling, it's no longer necessarily on the level of feeling, it's now on the level of choice. Emotions are consistent repetitions of certain feelings, the cultivation, the desire to have them, and expectation to feel in a certain way. So that brings us back to feelings and emotions, just that definition. But really, what are they? What is their function? In other words, how do they work? And what is their role? Those are the three questions I want to answer in the rest of the time here. What are they? How do they function? And what is their role? So I'd like to think of feelings as those instinctive impulses that make you feel good, bad, excited, panicky, and so on. Let me read this, and forgive me for reading some of this. The wording is kind of important, so I have to read more than rehearse some of this. So feelings, a natural instinctive state of mind. So natural comes, instinctive, it's there without any effort. A natural instinctive state of mind coming from one's circumstances, from mood, or relationship with others. When we combine feelings with personal temperaments, or just our like introvert, extrovert, that type of thing, with our personal temperament tendencies, and blend them with our conscious thought process, we create a concoction called emotions. And in the last 10 years even, what I'm going to call the science of the mind has just really exploded, because with technology has come opportunities to measure smaller electrical impulses and stuff of the brain. And so they're able to try to understand. I'm not really sure if they're getting further or not, but at least they get more data. So, you know, you see these things where they wire people all up and they're trying to make their brain says here what it does here when this happens and that happens. So it does lead to some interesting conclusions, even though it's not conclusive. So advances in neuroscience, the study of the brain, suggest our brains generate emotions through a combination of cognitive appraisal, which that's a big word. That basically means that you generate emotion, your brain does, through the combination of thought process and bodily perception, or what I'm going to call observation. So your emotion comes from two things. Actually from your thought process. The one psychologist actually said it comes from what you value. Imagine that. That's a non-Christian psychologist saying that your emotions are based on what you value. I thought that was kind of interesting. And what you perceive. In other words, what you see others around you doing, what's acceptable in your culture. And so as we look at this, not to just throw big words around, but it's hard to get away from big words when you get into some of this. I'm just going to put these up. So basically it works like this. An emotion is a complex. That means it's not just mental. It's not just physical. It's complex. It involves different parts. It's a complex psychological of the mind state that involves three distinct components. So you have the subjective experience, which is something that happens to you. This thing that happened, that accident, that whatever, that person pulling in front of you. Glenn, I can associate with you there. I'm not sure if that's a man thing or not, but it's for a lot of us. So we go on there, you know, that thing that happened. The second ingredient in this thing is a physiological response, which is the way you physically respond to what happened. And then the third thing is a behavioral or expressive response, which is the thought and the planned action after the initial involuntary response. Does anybody here just love mice? know how clear that thing is. So I was just thinking, let's say that I had this room just filled up with mice. And I would walk over here and open that door, and just a flood of mice would come roaring out there and run up everybody, and one mouse would run up everybody's leg. Would we respond all the same way? No, we wouldn't. But we would all have the same subjective experience, right? The sensation of a mouse crawling up our leg would all be the same universally if that happened. We would all have to... So now, even our physiological response would not necessarily be the same. I imagine some people's physiological response would be much higher pitched than others, for example, right? Even though we would probably all manifest a degree of disgust. But that the next thing would lead to a behavioral response. So after you realize that a mouse is running up your leg and you get that initial exhale of sound or disgust out, the next step that you take in getting rid of this creature running up your leg is what we would call behavioral, because some would run away from it, even if it's on them, and others would probably start swatting it, you know, and it's behavioral. We just respond differently. So those are the three elements. And so keep that in mind, that something, an emotion has that. A feeling does not have the behavioral response. A feeling simply has the first two. Oh, let's see here. So emotions are not merely simple reflexes. In other words, we can't say emotions are simply just an exhale because a mouse is running up my leg. They're immensely elastic responses based in our biological inheritance. That means how we're made physically, our cultural experience, how the people around us are, and in our cognitive or thought development, the way we think. Now listen closely. Emotions are shaped by our thoughts, by what we value, by what we accept as truth, the truth of life, and even by our ability to express ourselves. Now, I'm not going to defend that last one real hard, but I thought it was interesting. In the studies they've done, the bigger vocabulary somebody has, the more complex their emotional response is. Now, that may be simply, there could be one or two things happening. Maybe it actually is that way. Or potentially, you're just much better at expressing it with a bigger vocabulary. So I'm not sure which way it is. I'll let you take care of that one. Another thing is emotions may or may not have an outward expression based on personal temperament and what is culturally acceptable or socially. And we often say, so if you say a child is showing emotion, you're saying they're mad, they're sad, they're something, right? But in reality, emotion is not shown in your face so much. Well, I say, you may show your emotion in your face, but physical movement has no intrinsic emotional meaning. That means that by itself, it has no meaning. You as an observer, if you see emotion in my face, you have to interpret what does that mean. You have to give it meaning in the context. So if I tell you I'm hungry and you watch me eat breakfast, you will partly determine whether my feeling of hunger is justified by how big my breakfast was, right? Basically, that's what I was saying. You as an observer, just by me saying, ah, or even hear my belly growl, you're like, huh. You may say, maybe he's just got some other problems. Okay. For example, a smile, you can see a sad person smile. In fact, read a book. Sad smiles. Or you could have somebody crying for happiness. And it's possible, the one illustration one used was the thing of somebody on trial for murder that may be facing the death penalty. Some of those people be very stoic, and for to actually be condemned to death in this country for killing someone else, one thing that the jury has to agree on is that you are not repentant, or that you don't have sorrow for what you have done. And interestingly enough, this has led to this thing that it's really impossible for us to tell whether somebody's sorry for an action or not. We can think they are, but finally, a murderer on trial can weep and bemoan his action in seemingly sincere repentance, yet he may totally be doing it out for fear of the punishment he faces rather than that he's sorry, right? And we can't totally, that's where God says looks on the heart. He knows exactly what's going on. I don't. So what are the function, or how do emotions work? I'd like to read a few verses. I'll probably just start with some verses I read two weeks ago. Proverbs 4, verse 20. You don't need to turn to these. Just listen closely. Proverbs 4, verse 20 through 23 says this. My son, attend to my words. Incline thine ear unto my sayings. Let them not depart from thine heart. Excuse me. Let them not depart from thine eyes. Keep them in the midst of thine heart. So he's saying, keep them in the very center of your being, where the things are that are most important, where you really are you. And then he goes on and says, for they, the things that you keep in the center of your being, for they are life unto those that find them, and health to all their flesh. In other words, the way you feel, what you hoard up in the center of your heart, in the center of your being, actually is health physically, potentially, if it's good. And then he goes on, and the verse I really want to keep in mind is, keep thy heart with all diligence, for out of it are the issues of life. If you look up that word heart in Strong's, the first definition, I think, first or second, it gives you of another word that could be used is feelings. Keep your feelings with all diligence, for out of them are the issues of life. Now, isn't that pretty strong? Keep your emotions in check. So keeping your heart involves the controlling and building of your emotions. Proverbs 23, verse 6 through 7, talking about an evil man, says this, eat not the bread of him that hath an evil eye, neither desire thou his dainty meats, for as he thinketh in his heart, the thought process he has, what he desires, how he feels about himself, as he thinketh in his heart, so is he. Eat and drink, he saith unto thee, but his heart is not with thee. You know, how I feel about myself, how I feel about you, finally determines who I am. If we could go to Matthew chapter 12, verse 33 to 37. I won't read those verses. But it tells us there that every tree is known by the fruit on it. So again, what's happening in my heart, the way I feel about myself, and then consequently the way I react because of the way I feel, is actually putting a fruit on my tree. If we go to Matthew chapter 15, verse 18 through 20, Jesus tells us it's not the things that go into the man that defile man. But interestingly enough, he says it's the things coming out. So I don't think he's suggesting we can put in wrong things. I can't go look at wrong things, listen to wrong music, and expect good things to come out. But the fact is, for me to actually open myself to listening to wrong music, to looking at wrong pictures, there has to be something in my heart that wants that to start with, right? So he's saying it's not the things that go in, but what comes out that defiles a man, because finally there's something coming out that attracts me to certain things. Two phrases that I like that have, I'm not even sure who to credit for these, but whatever captures the mind captures the man or woman. Whatever captures the mind captures the man or woman. Then we have, you are not what you think you are. In other words, I'm not necessarily what I may think myself to be. You may have a totally different impression of me than what I do. But you are what you think. Excuse me. But you are, I better read this. But what you think you are. In other words, the things I dwell on, my emotions actually can show myself, can show me to myself. Okay, so what is the function of emotions? Have you ever wondered what the world would be like if nobody was emotional? Just fact-based. Be kind of a hard, uncolorful world, wouldn't it? You know, to me, emotion, feelings, add color to the landscape, kind of like green, red, blue. They add spice and salt for flavor. And I really wonder, as much problems as emotions and feelings seem to cause sometimes, you know what? I think it would actually be a lot worse without them. And I'll tell you why. I've corresponded a fair bit with people, and I generally have much more problem understanding them and them understanding me when I do it in text or email, especially intense subjects. I've offended people generally a whole lot worse by writing an email than I have by talking, potentially. At least unintentionally, let's say it that way. And to me, that's just amazing. So as much as cumbersome maybe as you think they are, think about how much worse it could be. Okay, now I'm going to phase over a little bit. I'll just let this... There's a lady by the name of Lisa Feldman Barrett. Her work is fairly widely credited. And so I guess I won't. Now, she's not potentially a Christian. In fact, I couldn't find one thing whether she is or isn't. She very carefully avoids the subject, so that indicates she probably is not, at least not what she could be. But she has studied this subject of emotional behavior for 25 years, and she's probably one of the better known current considered experts on it. And I like some of her thoughts. So I'll just share them in that context. In case you need to know who she is, she's Northeastern University's Distinguished Professor of Psychology and Director of the Interdisciplinary Effective Science Laboratory of Boston, Massachusetts. And she says this, she says, let's see, I don't think I have this on here. She says, emotions are not what you think they are. They are not universally expressed and recognized. They are not uncontrollable, and they are not hardwired. She goes on and says, it may feel like your emotions or feelings are hardwired and just trigger on their own in response to the circumstances of the event, but they do not. Now I'm going to shift back to my stuff a little bit here. You know, it works a little bit like this is, you can't see that too well, and understanding our responses. So we have this thing that comes into our life, an accident, a mouse running up your leg, whatever it is. So you have the circumstance or incidents, and you have your instinctive response, which is to jump up, to yell, to whatever. Then you have your temperamental response, which is whether you run or whether you fight the mouse. Then you have your conscious, what I call conscious reasonable choice response, which is how you relate to that. And then that triggers back up through, and it all affects and interrelates, and I'm not going to spend a lot more time on that. But I want you to consider that. So, now going back to Lisa Fieldman's Barrett's work, she says, emotions are not triggered, you create them. You are not born with emotional circuits. In fact, there is no such thing as an emotional circuit. So your brain has 86 billion neurons, and these things all make these little pathways. So when you have an experience, it creates a pathway, right? And but that pathway is not emotion. You have an emotion associated with that pathway, but that pathway itself is not emotional. So there's no such thing. You can't just say, it's just the way I am. That's not a legitimate excuse when it comes to emotions. Emotions are not triggered, you create them. They emerge as a combination of physical, the properties of your body, a flexible brain that wires itself. So, you know, think about this. With 86 billion pieces potentially wired different ways, there's endless possibilities, right? So our brain is adaptable. It's based on our culture, an upbringing, and environment. So there's a lot of ways to split some of this, but this is back to my thoughts. I'd like to split these into three levels, and I do this not because it's the right way or because it's necessarily even the best way. It's the way that makes sense to me. There are a lot of ways to do this. So first of all, I'd like to look at what what I call the instinctive level response, which is basically your core feelings. And in these, I've chosen to use four. You can find a lot of others. A lot of psychologists have been using six. More recent studies, they decided there was only four after all. And then some others say, oh no, there's eight. And then there's one guy that says there's 27, so take your pick, but I go with the four. So you have surprise, disgust, sadness, and happiness. And the reason I use these is think of a small baby that has not had any experience or hardly any. And what feelings will they have? They're pretty basic, right? And you could say, well, hunger and all those, very true, but I'm thinking of the actual feeling part of it, not the possible fact of it. So you have surprise. Let's say you have a baby and you just shoot a gun close to him. You know, almost any baby will jump, flinch. That's the initial surprise. So when we're talking about base feelings, we're thinking of that, just that little bit of time. You can't stay surprised in the way I'm using it as a feeling. It transitions. And disgust. Again, you have maybe a mouse up your leg. You would say that's disgust. But that disgust phases into something else. You can't stay in that disgusted stage, so to speak. Now, happiness and sadness, you say, well, you can stay happy. Well, sure you can. But in the way we're thinking, it's just that feeling of happiness. Maybe you wake up and that's just, you say you get out of the right side of bed. It's just that feeling. It's not, and you transition into something more stable. This is just a temporary. Sadness may be the same way. You get up, you have this horrible, dread. What is it? Well, it may be nothing. Maybe something you ate last night. So you can go on. So that's the four that I use. And as you look at the words, they're a little hard to see. We have traits of the Spirit, talking of God, love, faith, hope, and reverence. On the other side, we have traits of the God of self, pride, unbelief, bitterness, and rebellion, selfishness. And these all want to latch onto these initial feelings and use them for their own benefit. So let's say I feel disgusted. Pride is right away there trying to turn that into something more longer lasting, like that fellow. I don't think of a word right now. Or you could say disgust can turn into love if it's about a person anyway, and you decide to forgive them for whatever, for pulling out in front of you. So let's take this up to the next level, which is what I call temperamental responses. And here, this is by no means exhaustive. I'm just going to put different ones up here. Some of these show up good and some don't. But you know, that initial disgust might phase into some sort of aggressive behavior. Or maybe it'll make you frustrated or fearful of mice. You could go on and on. So basically, it goes from an initial feeling that anybody would have into something where your temperament begins to affect it. Then in the next level, we have, now this is the choice level where I respond to the input of that initial feeling and that temperamental part. And so we could have all kinds. Worried, detached, and I'm not going to go over these. Take way too long. I'll just put them up for you. Let's see. And so in all of these, you're basically deciding how to respond to that initial feeling, and your temperament would dictate one way. We have the darkness of self trying to influence one way, and if we're a Christian, the influence of the Spirit trying to influence it into a more positive route. Okay, let's see here. So core feelings. In the core feelings, we need to understand that these are what I call instinctive reflexive, in that there is nothing you can do about experiencing them. Don't even bother trying. I mean, yeah, I guess if you are totally freaked out, it might be a way to dampen them, but finally, you cannot never be surprised. You cannot never be disgusted. You cannot never be sad. And technically, everybody has happy feelings at some point in time that they may not relate to them positively. So don't even try. The natural personal temperamental response, like I said, this list is by no means exhaustive. Again, the experience of these is not something that you necessarily have a choice in or that comes directly under your control, but you do have a control over whether this shapes your long-term personality and the trajectory it brings. You know, you will be held accountable for amplifying, making them worse, or repressing, putting them under, the good ones, these natural tendencies. So together we have core feelings and natural personal temperament tendencies combining with experience, culture, environment, and conscious choice to form our emotional response to the circumstances and incidents of life. So going back to Lisa Barrett's work a little bit, so what are our emotions in their work, their function? She says this. Says they, emotions, are the way, and a quick way, and efficient, to relate to the world. Your brain constructs your current response and predicts what you should do based on past experience. So now let's say all of a sudden I face something I've never faced before. I won't have a quick response time. As a couple years ago, I forget who was with me. One of the fellows, we were working together, I forget. And I was coming through Lynn, and this lady in a minivan or small SUV pulled out in front of, just right out in front of me, probably 200-300 feet. Maybe it wasn't that. Maybe it was further. It seemed awful close. And then she saw me and stopped just right in my lane. And I don't know if it's a sign of boredom or what, but I have kind of thought, what would I do if this would ever happen? So almost instinctively, I don't remember thinking it, I whipped that steering wheel into the ditch, because I pretty much decided if I have a choice, I'll hit a tree or something other than hitting a vehicle, especially. I would have broadsided her at 60. This would have been, yeah, anyways. And so, praise to God, I actually managed to, with grass and mud flying, actually got out around her and went on down the road. But you know, if I would have never thought about that, I doubt I could have done that. And I credit God with doing it, right? But I still think the thought process of wondering what would I do in this situation gave me a pattern that was instantly there for use. Anyway. So the quick and efficient way to relate the world, your brain constructs current response and predicts what you should do on past experience. In using past experience to make meaning out of what you're currently experiencing, excuse me, it uses past experience to make meaning out of what you're currently experiencing. So therefore, emotion is the combining work of memory, imagination, and reason, creating guesses and giving a prediction as to what is the best route. In a moment, just like this, billions of brain cells, neurons, work together to come up with a plausible explanation for what you're facing and how to feel and, how to respond and even how to feel about it. Another research psychologist said this: you have more control over these guesses and predictions than what you know you do. They are not built in at birth, they are built. So what is this most like? How does your brain work? So do y'all know what, I hope I can say this word, experiential blindness is? So if you face something you've never faced, you haven't experienced it, you have experiential blindness, right? You've never faced this, so that's what we call experiential blindness. So let's give you a moment of experiential blindness. I would like for a couple people to tell me what that is, or what you see. So what is that? Think about it a little bit. Or maybe I should, rather than saying what is that, maybe I should ask the same question that your brain is technically asking you. And that your brain is saying, as you think about this, your brain is saying, what in my past is most like this? And so I've had some people tell me it's cabbage. I've had somebody else tell me it's, I forget now. I should have wrote those down. It was cabbage. I think the one thought it was a waffle or something. I forget what they all were. I had a couple. I don't think one person yet has told me that. I have not had two people agree on what it is yet. So you have an experiential blindness. What is it? Just a couple of you mind?
Soccer ball.
Soccer ball. Thank you. Any more?
Brain. A brain?
Okay, that's one I've had before. I'll go ahead. Was there no? Blown up fingerprint. Anybody else want to try? Okay, I'm going to show you. I took a picture that was not black and white, made it black and white, changed the resolution, but the shape and form is still there, okay? So I'm going to put the actual picture back up for you now. And I got to give credit to Lisa for this. She does this. So taking that back, now you all, if I would ask you what's that most like, you would say a snake. It's because now you've had the experience. Well, I mean, you could still argue about it, but you can see the head now, right? You can kind of see the pattern. So now that you've had the experience, you've got a pathway there that says, at least when Joe does this, it's a snake behind it. So anyway, experiential blindness. And that's kind of how you are when you are relating to people with emotional makeup you have. You have experiential blindness a lot of times. You've never experienced this, so you're trying to figure out how to relate based on what you previously experienced. So now, even though you see the same thing as you saw previously and weren't quite sure what it was, we would say you were without understanding, now you're seeing the same thing, but your recent experience helps you see that which is actually not there. This process helps you understand and anticipate the words I'm speaking. In fact, you are predicting what I'm going to say before I say it. So in other words, if I were to do this, this process helps you understand and anticipate the words I'm speaking before they come out of my, and anybody else could finish that sentence, right? Because you're predicting what I'm going to say before it's actually said, to a degree. Once you hear the first two words, you're trying to figure, your brain is figuring out how that sentence works. And so the interesting thing, emotions do the same in helping us to understand the people around us, me. And it also helps them to understand me. So emotion basically plays the role of communicator, scary as that is, of helping me understand you and you understanding me. Yet, this whole process is pretty scary because it's fraught with risk and danger, because it's a guessing game of predictions of what you mean before you've actually said it to a degree. And also guessing why you're responding to what I'm saying. So if I see you back there sleeping, of course I have to figure out why you're sleeping. Are you tired, or just do you just not like listening to me talk? So there you go. It works like this. So I'm not getting into marriage a lot, but I was going to pull this one in. So when a wife tells her husband, "You just don't understand me," she is in reality saying, if I look dumb like you do and acted stupid like you do and responded with the look that you're responding with, I wouldn't understand you at all. She's saying, you know, if I was acting like you are, then I wouldn't understand you. So she's guessing that he doesn't, and she may be right. You know, if a friend were to tell you, If a friend were to tell you, you just don't care about how I feel, what that friend is actually saying is, if I were to respond like you are to the things I'm trying to tell you, I wouldn't care a bit of how you feel. You're not responding like I would like for you to respond. We interpret each other's feelings, intents, and motives by comparing them to our own. Think about that. You know, the person most successful in understanding other people is the one that's most brutally honest with himself. Because basically, we expect other people to be like we are, as much as we don't like it when they are. And then we predict why they are responding the way they are based on why we would respond that way. This predicting and guessing game may be correct, or it may not be correct. Let's see here. Gone the wrong way. Let me put the card ahead. In reality, the emotions you detect in other people are at least in part coming from your own head. Think about that. So you determine, if you say somebody's angry, you're determining what anger is for you and saying they're acting like I would if they were angry, basically. And rejection would be probably a prime example of this. You know, I would say probably everybody did I have that message here on rejection or not? But probably everybody has experienced some rejection, right? And probably legitimately so. But the thing is, when I begin to find rejection under every bush and tree and in every relationship, I've made it up. I started looking for it, and now I'm finding it where it does not exist, based on a past experience. Another interesting facet to this whole thing of how we predict and guess is, we will be much more accurate in our prediction and guesses if we have experienced what the person we're observing has experienced. And also if we can copy their facial expressions, whatever they're doing. And this probably most obvious may be something like an emotion like grief. You know, someone who has experienced grief, the loss of somebody they loved very close to them, can speak to someone else who's facing that at the moment much better than somebody that doesn't know what grief is, right? We expect that in that area. Interesting thing, just on the side note, is they gave people a test. So they gave people different pictures, and they were supposed to guess what emotion this person was experiencing based on the picture. And what was funny about that thing is, if they were just allowed to look at this picture, just like I am right now, they could guess right about 75% of the time. Now, if they made them put a pencil in their mouth like this, well, I can't talk like that, but where they couldn't smile or they couldn't contort their face to match the picture they were looking at, they dropped down to like 40 to 30% of being right. And I'll give you, I feel really foolish, but this actually works this way. So we got a lot of people in our house that struggle a bit with eating. And so when you're feeding, especially a child, guess what you do? You take spoon, you know, you put food on it and you take it to their mouth, and totally subconscious, you know what I found myself doing? I opened my mouth in hopes that they respond accordingly. And so here at Bible school, Felix Durstein that was here, he got awful sick on me. And so he was sick enough, I was actually feeding him some. And I almost did the same thing, and I said, oh, Felix, I said, if I'm here with my mouth hanging open, I got to explain this emotional problem to you. But we do that. We actually try to copy to an extent. Of course, maybe not 100% at all, but we do it to an extent. In fact, this is so interesting, I need to wrap up here. We're getting there. That actors, when they have an actor that's acting out the part, especially if somebody that's emotionally unstable or a violent scene, those people that pay them to do that actually often encourage or maybe even pay for them to do therapy after they're done, because a good actor becomes the person he is to the extent that he actually is in danger of being mentally unstable, just like the person he was pretending to be. That's pretty weird, isn't it? And here's where this gets maybe even stranger, is the way you experience your own emotions is also through the same process of prediction and guessing. For example, and I've noticed this in myself, I can run, I don't know, some of you that work with me probably notice, I get my mind on my work, what I'm doing, the next thing, I don't get hungry that much. Now, If I have a service call, say, to a restaurant, and I walk in there to fix a problem, trust me, I get hungry. And I'm not there to eat. It's my brain predicting that I'm going to be hungry because I went into this restaurant, and when I go to a restaurant, I eat. So it's based on prior experience. Anyway, your brain is pre-wired to know whether or not you are comfortable or what you desire in a given situation. It uses this suggestion, how you feel about the situation and the people involved. So predictions link simple feelings to observation, what you see, and what you have experienced in the past. Your emotional response, and this is just my own thing, but your emotional response is a little bit like doing a search on Google, which probably all of us, most of us have done. You know, and I really hate when this happens, but I was buying equipment for, let's say, the business or Bible school. You know what? Guess what? 2-3 days later, I have bought this thing. I have forgot about it. I have moved on. You know what Google's still doing? They're still suggesting that maybe I would like to buy this thing if you don't have ad block. Or you go onto this site and this pop-up. See, and that's kind of how your emotion is. It remembers the past and like, yeah, so you got mad in this situation. Do you want to get mad here too? Go ahead and try it. You know, when you're put under a lot of pressure, say in having a test, for example, like college students, a lot of people respond to stress or pressure with an accelerated heartbeat. And generally, an accelerated heartbeat could mean a couple different things. And a lot of times, it actually just simply means that your body's gearing up, is becoming very alert, is going to do its positive best. But a lot of college students interpret a hammering heartbeat as something wrong physically. And so they'll run to the doctor and they have a flight response instead of a fight response. Even though the heartbeat thing is the same, they interpret it wrong. And this goes pretty far. In a sales class I took a number of years ago, I thought it was interesting as a body language expert there. And she told us to be very careful about the fragrance that we use in like deodorant. Because if somebody has had a bad experience with somebody, she suggested you use natural odors that occur more frequently. She said, so let's say you have a fella just loads himself down with Old Spice and he sells me a truck that doesn't work. If I go out to buy another truck and that salesman smells like the first one, even though I'll probably may never even think about it, I'll feel negative about him. And it's based on past experience. Let's see. And a couple areas, I guess one for you, especially you, man, some ladies do this too. You know, one thing that's helped me a lot is in public speaking. One thing that somebody told me is channel your nervousness. Some people tell me, they don't affect you. You're not nervous. I am too. If you shake hands with me after church, my hands are often cold. It takes me about 10 minutes to warm them back up. And we respond differently, but channel your nervousness. Actually use it as a springboard. Use that emotion to further your passion rather than to, and that's, I had one of you tell me, Joe, one time when you were preaching, you sounded angry. And I'm pretty sure I wasn't, but I think it was probably my emotions coming out that way, not to just make excuses, right? So channel, and that's what you have to do. Using your emotions to further your life, your job, rather than having them paralyze you. Use it as an inspiration. Another one thing that works real well for me is those of you that are married and have had children, you probably are familiar with Lamaze classes, you know, breathing. That's actually what helps me the most is when I get stressed out before, is to actually do breathing exercises. Another thing where sometimes we do this, have you ever woken up just with a terrible dread? I don't know, maybe some people that I've asked said they do, but just woke up and it just seems like everything is just terrible shape. I start sorting through my files trying to figure out why I feel so terrible. And there's some times that I went to bed with something weighing on me. There's other times it's simply nothing. It's a feeling. And it's a prediction based on something, maybe a bellyache, that what's wrong in my life? You know, all these things are predictions. If you're on the lookout for trouble because you have had this, you'll find it. But if in trusting faith we come to God and we resign these feelings to God's control and get on with life, it's often when I've had that happen to me, I look back middle of the day and I'm like, I forgot about it. It's nothing. You know, the pessimist, that's where a pessimistic personality is a choice. I know some pessimists don't think so, but it is. It's a choice, because if you're going to go through life thinking, I was scared this would happen, and you're trying to envision all sorts of things, I know a a fellow that he does that, and it's amazing how many of the things he feared has come upon him, but it's because he keeps a list, right? Or at least mental. If you don't think about it, it blends into your life. It's gone. It's over. But if you're going to keep a list, that's... And going on, this thing of predicting and feeling bad based on past experience is especially true for those who've had less than ideal childhood or maybe terrible early life experiences. You know, so often these people feel trapped by the past, by what dad, mom, others either did or failed to do. So often these people will feel stunted, like maybe they're even abnormal. But you know, the wonderful reality about emotional health is that just because you feel that way doesn't mean that you are that way. It's a little bit like a bird. If you take a bird and clip their wing feathers or pull some of the flight feathers out, they can't fly. So it's like this bird hopping around on the ground. You know, 6 months to a year, those flight feathers grow back out and you can fly. But if he never tries, he doesn't know. It takes effort. You have to be willing to go beyond what's comfortable. The other problem with emotional problems is we may actually become comfortable and identify with feeling bad about ourselves. While we would, any of these people would say that they don't like to feel bad about themselves, they don't like to feel rejection, for example, we become unwilling to quit looking for rejection. That's a choice. You do not have to look for rejection. You might experience it, but you don't have to look for it. We will identify ourselves by our problem to such an extent that we become afraid of not having the problem for fear of not knowing who we are without the problem. And that, friends, is the worst sort of bondage. The worst sort of bondage of all. There is such a powerful connection between what we think and how we end up feeling about ourselves and our relationships. The danger of a person being told that they're not worth much, that they're useless, that they're in the way, etc., mean things, is not the danger of that being true, but the danger is actually that they believe it to be true and respond accordingly. I hope you can follow that. So parents, for us, the danger is not so much that if we minimize a child, say they're worthless, they're in the way, that's not true. Not true at all with God. But the danger is that they will believe it to be that way because of the experience rather than giving God a chance. Emotions that seem to happen to you are actually emotions made by you. Keep thy heart with all diligence, for out of it are the issues of life. Be the architect of your experience. So what should be the role of emotions, just briefly here, in conclusion? Since emotions work in this way, and since emotions are so closely linked to my choice to continue or repeat a pattern, it means that I'm responsible for my emotions. You are responsible for your emotions. Now, I'm not saying when I say responsible that, boom, God's going to hammer you because you struggle with this. No. But I am saying that you are creating a trajectory that tomorrow, today you're making a choice that tomorrow is going to build your emotions of tomorrow, and you are responsible for that trajectory. The thoughts, feelings, intents, and actions I allow today are creating the basis for my predictions and consequently my feelings and emotions of tomorrow. So think of it this way. You are responsible not because you are to blame for all that you have experienced. That's not the reason you're responsible, because you're not. But you are responsible because you, and only you, are the person who can change your future by making positive choices today, be that forgiveness or something else. You know, as you seek God and give yourself wholly to Him, He will help you to use the key that unlocks a better tomorrow. So emotions are built, not built in. I wish we could all embrace this. It is a path to actually a healthier physical body, a more flexible and potent emotional life, and a life that pleases God spiritually in all we do. So many people go through their whole life trying to use others to help them feel good about themselves. May this be a pattern that stops with you. Because finally, nobody else can make you feel good about yourself for the rest of your life except you. And of course, Christ in the heart. No one else can ever make you feel loved, accepted, fulfilled, and happy for life. They can give you a temporary thing, but you soon drain them. You alone hold the key to these emotions, and it comes through the paradox or the strange way of complete surrender to Christ and a choice to be the right thing rather than to feel the thing. So the role of emotions is that of an interpreter, a weather forecaster. Their role is to facilitate and enhance communication. Their role should be one of inspiration and blessing. I'd like to read some verses here. Philippians chapter 4, verse 6 through 9. You can just listen again. Be careful for nothing. I should finish up here, shouldn't I? Excuse me. Philippians 4, verse 6. Be careful for nothing. I think ESV says, do not be anxious about anything. Don't worry. Be anxious about nothing, but in everything, by prayer and supplication, with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known unto God. And the peace of God, which passeth all understanding, all emotional experiences, shall keep your hearts and minds through Christ Jesus. Finally, brethren, whatsoever things are true, facts. Whatsoever things are honest, facts. Whatsoever things are just, facts. Whatsoever things are pure, facts. Whatsoever things are lovely, in factual. Whatsoever things are of good report, in fact. If there be any virtue, if there be any praise, think on these things. Those things which ye have both learned and received and heard and seen in me do, and the peace of God shall be with you. Let's stand for prayer.